Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to New Books Network. I'm Diadmus Silongkumar, the host of this channel. And today I'm here with Professor David Morgan to talk about his book, The Thing About Religion, An Introduction to the Material Study of Religion. Now, I believe this book is fascinating in a sense, and specifically for me, and I'm sure it will be fascinating to the listeners as well who are interested in the area of religious study and the study of religion in particular, as to what the material aspect of religion has to say about religion and the significance of it, and what the materiality aspect of religion can bring into the study of religion. And I believe this book really explores that aspects in depth, and I believe that this book will be really of help, and the conversation also will be really of help to people who are working on the area of religion and wants to look at the aspect of materiality, and also at the same time try to bring about a new way of trying to understand and think about the material aspect of religion. So I believe that today's conversation will be helpful to the listeners in that way, and also will be able to explore the book together with the author himself here. So let me straight away go to the author, Professor David Morgan. And Professor Morgan, can you tell us something about yourself? Yeah.
Well, I teach at Duke University, and doctoral training was originally in art history. I did a lot of work in religious studies at the University of Chicago, where I was a student. So I've always been very interested in the visual and material characteristics of objects and artifacts, and particularly images, and became especially interested in their reception and display, and who looks at them and why. That's guided much of my career.
Oh yeah, that's quite interesting. So you have explored this area of materiality of religion, and you have explored this aspect in many of your works, but also at the same time you have also come about with this book as an introduction to the material study of religion. So how did this book came about in terms of your scholarly work and in terms of the vision of this book itself?
Well, I had noticed in teaching over the years that many graduate students, PhD students, and master's students were very interested in the materiality of religions, but they didn't have much training in material analysis. How do you do it? That is to say, how to look at objects and think about them in terms of their particularly material characteristics. The tendency is always to turn objects and spaces into texts, to decode them for their content value, and to ignore their material presence. So I wanted to create a book that would speak directly to students about method, about dealing with objects and spaces and things in a way so that they could treat those as evidence and not simply as something that needed to be converted into text. And that's what this book was designed to do.
Oh yeah, I think in that sense, I believe this book has really beautifully done that aspect. So let's just straight away go into the contents of the book itself. And I think as you have done in the book, I think we will explore the book accordingly. I think one of the very first thing that you have explored in this book is also about the very conceptual framework, or trying to conceptualize this aspect of what is a thing. And I think trying to understand this and trying to encapsulate this is something I believe is very important in trying to understand the materiality of or the material aspect of religion. So can you say something about this one?
Well, the importance of asking such a basic question like that is to challenge the dominance of a certain concept of mind, which says in the classical religious as well as philosophical sense that the human mind is a kind of sovereign subject. It's a consciousness that is above and outside of everything. And that means that things are something the mind appropriates and does with and assigns meaning to. And things in themselves then are passive or blank, really. And they need to have a human mind to have significance or salience or meaning of any kind. And this is what I want to challenge by, like many others, I didn't invent this idea, explore thing as something more recalcitrant, that is more resistant. It pushes back. It requires human beings to engage it. And this breaks down the kind of dualist mentality of mind versus matter and sees human beings themselves as participating in the construction of meaning, not the unilateral authors of it.
I think that also goes into the very aspect also, the one that you look into very, the aspect of enchanted matter. And I think this matter, I mean, the question that I want to ask is also the question that how does matter get enchanted, or what are these enchanted matters in that sense?
Well, the framework I'm using there, I've learned a lot from people like Latour and others who are interested in thinking about breaking down the human being and unfolding, you might say, unfolding the human being into the larger world around it, so that we're part of webs or networks, assemblages that emerge and then fade away and come in and out. And we participate in things. We, you know, we're not the, as I said, the unilateral operator here, but we plug into our senses, our ways of interfacing with the world around us. We become part of these interactive webs. And things, you know, based on human neurology, though, we like to, we're very fond of addressing the whole network through a single node. So we privilege neurologically a single access, which I call a focal object. You know, that's the thing that tends to be our portal for access to the web and all of the distant components that belong to that particular network. So we tend to use an old-fashioned word, we fetishize that access. We make it very important, invest intense meaning in it. And the model here that we use so often is the human face. The human face is a kind of complex interfacial node where we communicate with one another. Human beings and many other mammals are very fond of the face, particularly the eyes. You know, that's the access to, as the tradition says, the soul. And so that tends to enchant that piece of matter. It tends to invest in great importance in it. And I think that's what enchantment means for me. You know, these things appear to have souls in them. That's because we pay so much attention to them.
I mean, that's actually quite interesting. And so this is where I think when you talk about the aspect of what is a thing and what is an enchanted matter, and obviously the question of agency also comes in, and also you talk about the different forms of agency in this. And so in terms of the materiality, the material aspect of religion, how do we understand agency, or what is an agency, and what are the forms of agency that we can see?
Yeah, well, this is crucial, because if you if we're able to recognize the agency of things, that's the first step away from a dualist approach, and recognizing that things push back. They act on us through their physical characteristics and the way that they engage our senses, our bodies. And recognizing that then helps break down the self into a process, an interactive process. And it brings into visibility the way that things are enfolded into their environments and how they interact with human beings in particular. If you're talking about religion, you're talking about human beings. So agency is critical, I think. It's how the world acts on us. and we respond, and religions can be understood in many ways. One way is through this kind of intense interactivity giving and receiving and engaging and failure and success. All these are different forms of interaction with things.
Yeah, and let me get to the point where you mentioned about the world acts on us. And I think, what is the processes as to how the world acts on us? Obviously, we talk about objects, or we may talk about rituals or whatever not. So in a sense, the question is also about, how does this agency work? How does this world act on us? And how do we as human beings, find that bridge of the world acting on us and us also incorporating ourselves in this process?
Well, I identified six ways that are readily apparent when you start looking at things. I don't think this may not be a, I don't mean this as an exhaustive list, but it's six ways in which things and spaces and other kinds of physical realities seem to exert agency. And this involves often the human interaction. So, a very familiar form is to imagine that a thing can act on us, heal us, encourage us, punish us, etc., because a supernatural person has endowed it, or force has endowed it with that agency, that power to act. Another common one is human beings consecrate objects or things ritually, and that transforms them in some sense. It gives them power to act. Our objects often seem to act on us, or act on us by virtue of the way they look. They resemble something we may know, and that gives them a kind of power. And then there are others. Objects possess power, are often understood to exert power intrinsically by virtue of their internal characteristics. Or objects, this is one of the most common, they're like tools. The tool transforms the hand and the arm into something it by itself it's not. I can do things with a hammer or a tool, any other tool, that I cannot do with my bare hands. So I become, in some sense, the tool, or it joins my being, and it's a kind of synthesized reality that acts. Then it expands my agency in some sense. And then finally, this is important for the study of the arts, whether it's dance or painting or any of the arts. Objects move us because of the way they're made or the materials they're made from. There's a kind of aesthetic engagement with things. They touch us, they make us sad, they make us angry, they seduce us. This power of the artistic medium to act on us is important to consider, because people, human beings, make things, beautiful things, ugly things, precisely to enhance these effects. All of these are ways of understanding that the world is more than we expect, more than it is in our unilateral power. And that's what I think all of these enchant the world in some sense. They give it a special power to move us, to achieve cultural work, work that we can't do by ourselves.
So moving on, you talk about theories of religion. And I think coming to this aspect of trying to see and understand the theories of religion from material study of religion perspective, I think this aspect is something which is very important. And so you have a chapter on how certain theories of religion dematerialize religion, right? So I think that idea is something which is interesting. So when we talk about theories of religion, can you give us an overview of how, the theories of religion has developed?
Oh, well, I mean, if you're talking in particular how various philosophical or theological religious theories, theories about religion that dematerialize religion, is that what you're asking about? I mean, this is one thing to consider. I mean, because there are vast philosophical systems that have influenced thought through millennia that prize human agency and the human mind, human understanding above all else. In the classical ancient version, the idea of that humankind is the measure. Man is the measure of value in the universe. As goes way back to the ancient Greeks and beyond. You can understand the importance of that in some respect. You know, it values the human being, which we think is important. On the other hand, it can devalue everything else. In the Christian mythological system, God created the universe for human beings. So human beings are at the top and everything else is below, and everything is a kind of fodder for humans to use as they see fit. This can produce ecological and does produce ecological disasters. And I think what we're trying to recover in, you know, recent developments like the new materialism and others is a reorientation to recognize the power and value and autonomy in some sense and various kinds of agencies of the natural world. And to resituate human beings from being at the top of it, at the apex, to being participants within it. You know, we're shaped by our environments, we participate, and we have a kind of a deep responsibility to make sure the world works and continues, and we can find a constructive place within it. So this approach that I'm saying is pushing against a very old tendency to regard thought as the highest expression of the human being, thought in the sense of rational cognition, as what joins us with the divine, you know, in the Platonic scheme of things. And to say, well, yeah, but matter and bodies matter no less. They're equally as important, aren't they? And they weren't. In the Platonic ideal, the body, Socrates talked about it as perishable rubbish, and matter was inanimate and passive and received the impress of thought. All of that raises thought and language far above everything else and sees it as what's divine in the human being. And while no doubt thought and language are a fundamental aspect of our being as human beings, it's not all there is. And somehow we need to understand in a much more complex way how human beings are more than just ideas and language. So both theologically and philosophically, that tradition tends to dematerialize religion and focus on beliefs and philosophical ideas within religious systems of belief, and to just basically ignore the body as a kind of a minor problem or an annoying problem. And that's, you know, that's a big problem, I think, for anybody who wants to see religious behavior in a much more robust way and think about food, think about clothing, think about spaces and the built environment. Think about objects of all kinds and images and all the things that are fundamental to religious practices.
Yeah. I mean, to kind of push forward, I mean, what you have said in the book and what you are proposing now is, so what is the value of philosophical thought in that sense? For example, when we, through philosophy, we do so much of abstraction, right? So these abstract thoughts are something which might not be in sync with the reality or, you know, our practices and beliefs and all. But then some of these concepts are very much detached from the everyday reality as we are. So somehow these concepts are some things which obviously as humans we can come up in. And I think that is a significant aspect of what a human person is. So at least people coming from the philosophy background might argue as to the usage or the importance of these philosophical thoughts and, you know, how might it work. So in your mind, how does a philosophy kind of chip in and work in that sense?
Well, it remains, extremely important. I wouldn't want to be understood to say you can only do the material culture of religion if you abandon philosophy and theology and more formal systems of thought. I mean, those are essential tools. And so much religious tradition is invested in philosophical systems and in theological conceptions of the cosmos. So we have to pay attention to that. What we're really looking for is how are mind and matter part of the same thing, rather than split them. And think about language and ideas and philosophical systems and cosmologies as deeply invested in space and matter and dress and the variety of bodily practices and rituals that human beings engage in. But I don't think that's hard to do. What I want to avoid is the either or. You know, it's how do we integrate thought and practice in understanding religion? If we can, then I think we're really much closer to religion on the ground, how it actually happens.
Yes, and I think one of the proposals here is also that our mind is entangled with the material world. And I think that is where the aspect of, as you have mentioned, the aspect of new materialism comes in. So can you elaborate something more on this aspect of new materialism?
Well, it's been a development that's not unprecedented, but it's come to the fore in the last 20 or 30 years in the humanities. And it's had a very important impact, I think, in helping dislodge the sovereign consciousness model of the human being and to recognize the place and importance of everything from the weather to catastrophic events to microbes and we are the human. If you just look at what the human body consists of, it's a integrated system of hundreds and maybe thousands of life forms. Our guts are full of these microbes. We are not us without all of those things. And it's a human being is a complex dance of life forms. And illness can be understood as when those life forms get out of balance, you know, when you don't have the right bacteria or you have too much of a certain bacteria, et cetera, that this causes that imbalance is what is ill health. And, recognizing the richness of the world around us transforms us. And I think the new materialism has really taken this very, very seriously. And there's obviously political dimensions to this when you think about, you know, ecology as a kind of new framework for understanding the human being and for understanding human responsibilities, not just to humans, but to other animals and to the world around us. And this has probably come to the fore, I think, in what's called the Anthropocene, where we recognize the, in a sense, disproportionate impact of the human species on this very fragile ecological system in which we live. I think the new materialism has really tried to recenter the human being in this planet, you know, to understand our participation in the life of this planet. And as a result, has redefined the human being in a fundamental way. Religion scholars are very interested in this because it helps us rediscover the human actor and the agency of everything that actor encounters in the natural world. So it's a it's you know, it's I mean, there are very, very different versions of this and some, but I think, you know, overall it can be a way of energizing religious studies.
Yeah. So you have a chapter on, the title of the chapter also is specifically, what is the material study of religion, right? So let me just put that chapter, the question of the chapter as a question to you now, that what is the material study of religion? Can you give a precise response to that one? Yeah.
Yeah, I think it for me and my work, it begins with recognizing embodiment as a process. Human beings are born with incomplete bodies. You know, we need to grow, but one of the most fundamental things is we need to learn our place in our domestic worlds and in our social worlds through the education and formation of the body. As Marcel Mauss described many, many years ago, we need to learn the techniques of the body. How do you come to be in this thing, the human body? And it's plastic. It learns and it changes and it we're really dependent. We're in some sense existentially incomplete. Our bodies are they're not hammers. They're not drills. They're not wrenches. We have to craft those tools to extend the body, to reinvent the body in some way. So I think the basic insight is that we are not a walking brain, a floating brain. We are enfleshed. All of our senses are enfleshed, and our engagement with the world around us is fundamentally embodied. So we have to track that out and understand. Once we do, we can start to understand, I think, why people pray to images, why they carry objects with them, why they have to go to a certain space to worship, why certain parts of nature are holier than others. We can understand the deep connections to objects and places and you know, various kinds of physical formations of social worlds. And that these are not incidental, these are not neutral background for religions. They are a fundamental part of making religion happen. I think that's the key issue in the material study of religion, that we take these things seriously because they wouldn't happen otherwise. When people, I've watched a lot of people pray, and you watch an adult pray, sometimes they get down on their knees and they fold their hands and they look very much like a two-year-old or a three-year-old praying. And that's because that's when they learn to pray. So the body is shaped over time, and the body is fundamental to the practice. People bow their heads. Why do they bow their heads when they pray? Because that's the way they were taught to expect that the saint or the god hears them through this demeanor. They have to present themselves bodily to the sacred other, to shape their relationship to that other. So the body is not incidental. It's a fundamental aspect of religion, of the reality that religion holds dear.
Yeah, and I think moving on to be specific about, you know, the materiality of religion. So you have a chapter on how religion happens materially, and you pick out seven aspects to discuss on it. And also, you also say that there are many more aspects that could be explored, right? And one of the aspects which I would like to have seen explored is the aspect of soundscape. I think soundscape is something, I don't know, it's personally something which is of interest to me. So before coming to soundscape, right, the seven aspects that you have discussed, can you give a brief highlight on the aspects that you have discussed in this chapter?
Sure. I mean, I start with the one I was just talking about, body work, I call it. This is critical. The body itself is a powerful element in religious life. I'm thinking particularly of ornamentation. You think of the importance, the ancient importance of tattooing, for instance, piercing the skin, scarification to modify the surface of the body, using various kinds of objects to shape the body. The body is seen as a kind of plastic medium that needs to be adapted to social status, social rank, and to gender or sexual characteristics, identities that make it participate in the social world of a people. Healing. I mean, one of the most fundamental functions of religions is to provide healing, whether it's spiritual healing or physical healing or both, as virtually identical. And all of these things, activate the body. Consider it not just a blank canvas, but as something that, by changing the body, you change the self, the soul, the person's social relations. Then I looked at if the first one looks on the outside of the body, the surface of the body, the next thing to consider is the inside of the body, which is very difficult to study for those of us who have not had medical training. But ingestion, taking things into the body, the task of eating, tasting, the use of pharmacological agents, all of this belongs very much to the study of religion. And we need, I think it would be wonderful if people trained in medical studies became religion scholars. I know some who've done this, and they have a lot to offer because the history of healing and pharmacology is so important for the understanding of religions. So this is one more way of taking the body much more seriously than was often the case before. I'm picking up something from Foucault and others in the role of punishment, another aspect of the body, punishing the body as a form of social control. And we see this in monasteries, we see it in the public square, the history of the auto de fe, the Inquisition, orchestrating social events that for executions, for instance, of heretics. All of these kinds of practices exert the punishment on the body for its broader social impact. And religions have exploited this forever. I have another one called Facing the Sacred, and this is the power of the human face as one of the most important zones for Homo sapiens. The face is charged with meaning and power. So understanding portraiture, understanding modifying the face, the role of facial expression, all very critical. Imaging ideology, the importance of showing social rank and the power of sculpture, images, temples where priests present themselves or leaders present themselves to the people, to study the very, very close relationship between religion and the state, religion and power is, I think, something that material study of religion can contribute to in an important way. Two final ones I'll just mention quickly. It seems to me we can understand a lot about religion if we look at it as a sacred exchange. There are kind of economies that come into being through barter, through trade, through gifting. All of these are social practices of exchange that become a kind of social anatomy. They provide the means of transaction and relationships and ongoing relationships. We need to understand those as material processes. So I've tried to sketch that out. And then finally, I'm really interested in what I call harvesting purpose from chance. Chance is one of the most fundamental characteristics of the universe. And I don't think religion scholars have begun to understand fully what that means for religion. Managing chance is something we do in so many different ways. And divination, for instance, is one of the most common features of religions around the world and over time. And it is a way of harvesting purpose from chance, turning the randomness of events into some kind of messaging or meaning that can benefit human beings. So those are, and I'm thinking about dice and tea leaves and all kinds of tarot cards. These are all material systems for interpreting events. There's a very, very long list. And we, you know, they are material processes that can tell us a lot about how people put their worlds together in the face of randomness, random events.
Yeah, I think these seven aspects that you have discussed in this chapter is fascinating in itself. And you also, as I've said, you also mentioned about many aspects that could be mentioned. And when you talk about harvesting purpose from chance, I think this is something, a fascinating aspect, actually, as you have mentioned it now. I think it really struck me personally also. I mean, in my research work, right? But then I've never thought about it in terms of harvesting purpose from chance, but then I've thought about it in a different way. But I think this will open up certain new ways of trying to understand this aspect of divination in that sense. I think that's something which is quite fascinating. Yeah, so I want you to comment something on the aspect of soundscape. Now, I mean, you haven't dealt about soundscape in this chapter, but I'm sure you can give some comments, because I carried out fieldwork on my own communities, and I come from a Protestant Baptist dominated place, right? And with when you talk about objects and all, and you know, the power in object and all of those things, I mean, the Baptist denomination really detests this aspect of objects having power and using objects and all of those aspects. But then one of the aspects is which I've seen personally in my field work and in my research, is the aspect of soundscape, whether it may be preaching, I mean, someone preaches, standing up and preaching, whether it may be a congregational prayer, you know, it has a sense, something that gives to you, but also at the same time also about the beats of certain instrument and the singing together, and has so much of impact and significance in the particular context that I'm working on. So I wanted you to comment something on the aspect of soundscape. Yeah,
when I drafted the book, I had soundscape as one of the, it was eighth or ninth, and then I had landscape because I was going to play off landscape and soundscape. The chapter was way too long, so I had to make some uncomfortable choices. I also had a long section on gender and sexuality, which is, I mean, such a profoundly embodied material component and is so important. So yeah, it's a pity. One could write an entire book just on, you know, enumerating the importance of so many different characteristics. And I indicated that this is not an exhaustive list, because I know people are going to say, well, how come he didn't write about this? You know, that's just a part of the process. But soundscape is really exciting because, for one reason, as you state, there are religious subcultures which are very fond of avoiding certain things. They don't want to be associated with images. You mentioned conservative Protestant, and you could look at certain versions of Islam and certain versions of Judaism, certain versions of Buddhism. They just avoid those kinds of objects because they feel they are deceptive or too material or too inappropriate for their religious practices. Interestingly, though, they always have some material dimension, and you, if you, for instance, Protestants, they have the Bible, and I don't know about the Baptists you study, but in the United States, Baptists often they have that Bible in their hands and they shake it when they preach, and they're very fond of opening it. For instance, they open it and point to a verse, and that's a form of divination. So they're using the Bible as a random generator to channel God's will into their lives. You know, that's one way in which the material thing is still important. They don't have images often, but they do have that Bible. They also have, as you point out, their spaces, and they practice song and sometimes music like organ or piano, guitar. But sometimes it's just voice, and they can become very, very good at choral harmony. producing a sense of, it can be for some very ecstatic. I mean, they are deeply moved by the sound in the space. And if you look at the spaces they use, they often choose very, very undecorated interior spaces so they can maximize the effect of sound waves bouncing off of plain walls to enhance the volume or the depth of the sound they're producing. So they produce the sound, but then the sound comes back and affects them. And they create these special places where this happens. That's part of the soundscape that they create, and that in turn creates them. So understanding this kind of dialectical dimension is important. And it's not often always the words per se, but it's the sounds that move them. Certainly, you know, importantly connected to content, but it's also the sound quality. Just like, you know, if we talk about images, it's the color and the texture of the imagery that influences, as well as the subject matter. So part of the material study of religion is not to focus exclusively on content or semantics, but also the material conditions for producing value or salience. And I think soundscape is a great way to do that. The other thing I like about soundscape, as it's been studied over the past 20 or 30 years, is it spills out of the religious setting, the temple or the church or wherever, into the world around. And people create different soundscapes. So you can follow people. There's the domestic soundscape, there's the workspace, there's the public square, there's the temple. All of these have characteristic sounds and can be understood produce certain kinds of human behavior, certain kinds of attitudes, certain ranges of feeling.
Yeah, I think exploring this skepsis is something, soundscapes and landscape is something which is quite really fascinating in terms of understanding the material aspect of religion. And obviously, this is something out of what you have written in this chapter. But as you have also said that you have written on this, but you have to cut down. So I like you to explore these aspects in some other works. That'll be really interesting, actually.
I do have a chapter in The Embodied Eye. You might look at it. It came out in 2010, I think. And that has a chapter on Protestant worship spaces and the soundscape and the kinds of spaces they choose for worship.
Oh, yes. That'll be fascinating. Yeah, that'll be great. I'll have a look at it. So moving on, I think now... there's a chapter on how you talk about the power of objects. Now, here, I think you kind of focuses on Christianity, and also you focus on Moses also. So, I mean, can you tell us something about the aspect of one in Christianity? I mean, what role did it play, and, you know, how did it work in Christianity?
The wand, yeah. One could write on any number of different objects as power objects, the object. The wand is very interesting to me because it occurs across many, many, many different cultures and over a considerable amount of time. The wand is an object that I found especially important because one holds it in the hand and then points with it or gestures with it. Its close cousin, you might say, is the scepter that kings or rulers use. It's a sign of power, but is also an extension of the body. It's one of these basic tools that can direct the will, and that's often how the wand is used to aim the will or the intention. And somehow, having the wand in the hand enables this better. It enhances human action, like any tool, I suppose. So I started with the ancient world and looked at a variety of cultures, but then focused especially on the wand of Moses, which is easily overlooked. But it really, throughout his story, he has a wand, and it's not just a staff. It's actually described as something shorter, some kind of wand. And it becomes the not just the symbol of his authority, but it becomes the means by which he enacts God's will, God's direction for the liberation of the Israelites. And it goes on the road with Moses, and Aaron, his brother, also has a wand. And then there's a long sort of interesting folklore about what happens to that wand after Moses died. It's tradition says placed in the Ark of the Covenant, so it's intimately associated with that special place where the tablets of the law are, which this is the throne seat of God when he descends to the tabernacle to speak. So it's really at the crux of Jewish life, the life of the Israelites. So it's a very, very powerful object. And then it's shown in the history of both Jewish and Christian art up until the present. I mean, I found depictions of wands on and on and on, and probably has a lot to do with the rise of the representation of the wand in neo-paganism. The history of neo-paganism is a little sketchy, but it's not always clear when they incorporated wands, but it is clear it starts very much in the 18th and 19th centuries. So there's this intertwining of practices, and I was just fascinated to see this. And the main argument of the chapter is, how do we understand this object? Is in Harry Potter, the wands have magical elements inserted inside of them, special feathers or dragon teeth or whatever. But in the history of wands from the ancient world, from the Oracle at Delphi, clear up to Jewish and Christian, particularly Christian in the modern era, there is nothing inside the wand. It's the object itself. So I wanted to understand how can this object have power if it doesn't have a soul itself, if it doesn't have, you know, some inherent power? How do we understand its power? How does it exert effects? And that's where I found the network theory of actor network theory helpful, to understand the wand as connecting the user to a web of relationships that gives this wand power.
This chapter, again, itself is fascinating in that sense, because you talk about religion and time here. And this is where you bring the example of the Cathedral of Notre Dame de Paris. And you say that every ancient structure is riddled with the marks of time. And this is where you talk about object in time, where contestation happens, like a lot of contestation happens, whether it be political, social, cultural, and all of those aspects. So I think this chapter I have seen is very fascinating. So can you elaborate something on this very aspect of religion and time that you talk about?
Yeah, we are creatures of time. It's the most fundamental quality about us. We have all kinds of ways of ignoring time, masking time, denying time, you know, pretending it's not affecting us. But we are fundamentally temporal. That's the character of our existence. And it's also the characteristic of the material world we live in. And much of human culture is devoted to repair or reforming, restructuring, renewing the material world. And Notre Dame, the Cathedral of Notre Dame, was a great example of this, because I start before it was built, try to go back to the Celtic inhabitants and then the Romans. And the site of the isle, the island in the Seine, was a very important piece of real estate for material reasons. It was easier to protect. You have water, you had, they used local stone to construct there. And it became then the site for this, a series of religious structures, and the cathedral itself in the 12th century. But it wasn't done when the cathedral was done. It in a sense, the building is never done. And I think that was struck. What struck me most dramatically about this was the fire a few years ago. I remember on the day it happened, I watched it on social media. I was so shocked because I'd been there to visit it years ago, and it meant a lot to me as an object. It's such a beautiful cathedral. But it made me realize, you know, this is the history of that object. It's always undergoing change. We like to lock it into our minds as this enduring icon of permanence, but it's not. It's not that at all. And neither are we. We're always changing. So, you know, there's a important element of the study of religion is to recognize the effects of time and how human beings materially negotiate the passage of time. We're missing something about religion if we don't recognize this. And that cathedral and the extensive changes it has undergone in the inside and on the outside over time were a kind of laboratory for me to make this point.
Would you like to readdress something or highlight something which I haven't or I failed to highlight in the conversation here?
Just a brief mention on the final chapter that we didn't get to talk about was tracking objects acquired by missionaries in the South Pacific and then following them to museums in Boston and London. It's the cultural biography of artifacts, and at each place, they acquired different languages, different taxonomies for what they were, what they were called. That was a chapter in which I could look at the intimate relationship between nomenclature and object within evolving cultural settings. It's an important, you know, it comes back to our earlier point about the relationship between things and language. It's very important, language in organizing the world around us. And that was something I found extremely interesting.
Yeah, thank you for highlighting that one. I think that question has escaped me too. I have written it down here, I think, but I think thank you for pointing out that one, the aspect of words and agents in terms of the material aspect that you discuss about in this chapter. I think this has been a fascinating conversation, Professor Morgan. And so is there any projects that you are currently working on, or is there any thing that is coming up? Yeah.
Yeah, my current book project is I'm writing a book on the visual culture of revelation, not just the book in the Bible, but revelation as a fundamental feature in many different religions. What role do images play in depicting revelation, but also in shaping dreams and visions that become revelatory? So it's a big project, but I'm just getting started, but I'm really looking forward to it.
That's such a fascinating project. I mean, I would love to, have another conversation on that project of yours. That's such a fascinating thing. Yeah. Yeah. So if anyone would like to reach out to you regarding this book, how can they reach out to you?
Oh, it's email at Duke, David. Morgan@duke.edu, and it's for sale at the University of North Carolina Press. They can just Google that and find it there, or Amazon.
Yeah, thank you so much, Professor Morgan, for being here in New Books Network. Thank you for such a wonderful conversation.
Yeah. It was my pleasure. Thank you.